As the attorneys are getting ready, I will call the second case. Our second case today is case number A24-0595. Chad, is it Siegel or Siegel?
Siegel.
Chad Siegel versus Drew Evans. Good morning to counsel. And I understand that we have a certified student attorney who will be arguing the case today. Practitioners, a certified student practitioner today who will be presenting oral argument, and I assume that you are the supervisor.
Yeah. I am.
Excellent. As you both are well aware, you will be given 15 minutes for your argument this morning, and counsel for appellant, you will be given 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before beginning your argument, both parties feel free to take time to adjust the podium to your comfort level. And if you would please identify yourselves and your client for the audio record, it would be much appreciated before you begin your argument. With that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tim Stowell, and I represent the appellant, Chad Lauren Siegel, on this matter. I'm a supervised practitioner, and Bradford Colbert is here supervising me today. Now, there are two issues before the court today. The first is whether the BCA is prohibited from requiring Mr. Siegel to register as a predatory offender, where the trial court dismissed the predatory charges, implicitly finding that probable cause was not supporting the predatory offenses he was charged with. The second related issues is whether the statute of limitations would bar Mr. Siegel's claims for relief. Now, this is a case about predatory registration requirements, and the predatory registration requirements in Minnesota are different than the rest of the states. In Minnesota, an individual can be required to register as a predatory offender based on a simple charge of a predatory offense.
Well, a charge that's supported by probable cause.
A charge that is supported by probable cause, regardless of whether or not they are convicted of that later predatory offense, so long as they're convicted of some other offense arising out of the same set of circumstances. This means the only question in determining whether someone should be required to register as a predatory offender is whether probable cause supports the predatory offense. Not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, not clear and convincing evidence.
But you would agree there is nothing we can do about that because it's a legislative enactment.
I understand that at this time. Correct. But it's probable cause that exists to make that determination. And just above reasonable suspicion, it's hard to comprehend why they would use probable cause as a standard for determining registration, when registration itself likely carries heavier ramifications for someone than a conviction of an offense arising out of the same circumstances. If that doesn't appear troublesome enough, the BCA is the sole entity that has the authority to require registration in Minnesota, not the sentencing court. In most states,
although the court is you know, one of the arguments you're making here is you're asking us to, in effect, supplant what the statute says in terms of notification procedures with another court-developed process. I'm not sure we can do that, and it strikes me that the court is one of the entities that is charged with notifying an offender of the registration requirement. So even though the court, like this court, can't determine whether someone has to register because that's governed by the statute itself, there are obligations on the court and probation officers, corrections agents, and people like that to notify someone of their registration responsibility, right?
Thank you, Your Honor, and that is correct. However, it is that the court may not modify a person's duty to register based on the pronounced sentencing or disposition order, is what it says in the statute itself. So while they might be able to provide notice, it isn't the sentencing court that has the authority to require someone to register on its own.
Mr. Stowell, I'm very tuned in to the complexity of the sex offender registration process, excuse me, the predatory offender registration process, as it sits in Minnesota, and arguments that this is a liberty interest in terms of reputation and so on. But tell me what we as a reviewing court, what can we do to fix or remedy the situation? I mean, what is it you want us to do for your client that we actually have the power to do?
Basically, finding that probable cause doesn't exist to support the predatory offenses in the first place, and that he shouldn't be required to register as a predatory offender based on the charges that were brought.
We couldn't make a determination of probable cause, so maybe what you're asking is us to have the trial court offer a probable cause hearing on an offense that was... It seems to not make a lot of sense.
Your Honor, I'd be just requesting that this court affirm that the decision made by the trial court back then was in fact a motion for directed verdict precluding that predatory offenses of kidnapping to go forward to a jury at trial, finding that there was no probable cause since
it didn't.
All right,
I think I'm understanding what you're saying. So we should look at the fact that, what the district court did and say that that equates to no probable cause.
That'd be correct, Your Honor. And since it was found at that trial that there wasn't enough probable cause for it to go to a jury, or wasn't enough facts in the record to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he could be found guilty of those kidnapping charges, that he shouldn't be allowed to register based
But isn't on what the district court found that the state couldn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt the kidnapping charge, not whether or not there was probable cause at the time of the charge? Because I guess as I understand this, is the state presented its case, and then the motion was brought. And so at that point, the state is bound by a beyond a reasonable doubt standard, not a probable cause standard, correct?
That would not be the case, I don't believe, Your Honor, because it is the probable cause of the predatory offense charges that is what matters here. And
You're asking us to rely on the district court's determination when they granted the motion for judgment of acquittal. And my question is, what is the standard the district court was applying at the time that it granted that motion?
Thank you, Your Honor. At that time, they found that no reasonable jury would be able to conclude that he would be guilty of the kidnapping offenses. And is later found in State v. Florence. That is the functional equivalent of a dismissal for probable cause.
Would we be engaging in fact-finding if we would say that there was no probable cause?
I wouldn't believe so, because it was based on the record of the trial court itself at Mr. Siegel's trial at the time. And I think
the charging instrument. I mean, we would, of course, have deference to it's such a low threshold, we'd have give deference to the state, but I'm not certain if that wouldn't require us to make findings.
Thank you, Your Honor. And it is the initial determination of probable cause on the complaint that the BCA contends is what the standard should be for requiring someone to register. And what we are arguing is that it should be the probable cause standard mentioned in State v. Florence, that the facts on the record would preclude granting of a motion for directed verdict. And here, in Mr. Siegel's case, the motion for directed verdict was granted, implicitly finding that there was no probable cause to support the charges that he would be required to register as a predatory offender on.
Mr. Stowell, how would we distinguish this case from State versus Hawkes if we were to agree with you on the nature of what probable cause means here and equating the directed verdict of acquittal with a finding of no probable cause? How would we square such a ruling with State versus Hawkes?
Thank you, Your Honor. And I think the reason for that is that in State versus Hawkes, Mr. Hawkes was convicted of a fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct charge, while the charges for a fourth degree were not found at trial. And they actually made it to the jury, I believe, at that trial, where they found that it couldn't be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And since it wasn't until after his trial, after the acquittal by the jury, that Mr. Hawkes contested his registration, they couldn't have an evidentiary hearing based on that. So they had to look back to the original complaint to make that determination. And in here at the trial, in Mr. Siegel's case, they found that before this issue could even reach the jury, that there wasn't enough probable cause for him to be found guilty of those charges.
there wasn't enough evidence. That's what I'm struggling with. I think it was Judge Larson's question, the equating of is there probable cause to support a charge with the is there sufficient evidence for this jury, having heard all the evidence, to find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
That is correct, Your Honor, and that's what brings it back to State versus Florence, where they found that where the facts aren't sufficient to...
But isn't Florence a case where there was a probable cause hearing?
It was a probable cause hearing, but the standard that they're mentioning in Florence is that where the facts on the record would preclude a motion for directed verdict if proved at trial. So here we have a situation where Mr. Siegel was standing at trial, and they found that directed verdict was granted. So it wouldn't have been precluded at trial, and the only outside information could potentially be reliable hearsay that wouldn't have made it onto the record. But what was proved at jury found that it was enough to preclude those charges.
But isn't there a temporal problem with your argument? In that, so for example, at the time of a charge, you have a witness who is going to testify to one specific element of the offense. And between the time that the state brings the charges and when you get to trial, that witness dies for some reason unrelated. That affects the ability of the state to prove one of the elements at trial. So the state presents its case without that witness, and the judge determines there's not enough evidence here to prove one of those elements. I'm granting the judgment of acquittal. And you can see how there would have been probable cause at the time that the charge occurred while the government was not able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt at trial because of an intervening act that was not caused by the state. Why isn't the fact that there's that temporal difference here? We don't know what the state would have brought if there had been a probable cause hearing at the time of the charge. Why doesn't that make this case more similar to Hawkes or Haukos than to Florence?
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'd submit that it's because, to kind of flip your version of the facts around, that the initial determination of probable cause is based on ex parte communications for the most part.
And a surveillance video, correct?
Potentially. And it's determined by the prosecutors, and it's brought forth, and a judicial determination could be made on that probable cause to find that it's sufficient to detain and charge someone with that crime. However, within that same time frame, while a witness for the prosecution might not be able to make it to trial, information and evidence that the defendant could supply in the meantime could potentially exonerate him.
But does that change the probable cause determination at the beginning? I mean, this still gets into my temporal problem with this argument. That doesn't, just because the defendant then comes forward with witnesses that are able to overcome that lower burden of probable cause, does that necessarily mean the government didn't have probable cause at the time it brought the charge?
I don't think it does mean that they didn't necessarily have probable cause at the time to bring the charge, because, again, probable cause is a very low threshold to meet. It doesn't require proof of an actual crime being committed, just a probability or a chance that it has been brought. And there's many times where probable cause to charge someone initially is found, and they are later exonerated and charges are dismissed for any other reason. And in this case, it's simply that we're requiring someone to register, even if it could be proved after based on another conviction, as long as it's from the same set of circumstances, that we're saying you have to register based on this. And the charge of the initial predatory offense could be baseless, but found probable cause enough to bring forward in those charges, usually complemented by other charges of non-predatory offenses. And it's hard to dismiss outright that these charges shouldn't be brought.
Do you agree with the district court that concluded that the kidnapping charge and the assault charge arose out of the same set of circumstances? Do you agree that they did not, or do you take the position that they did arise out of the same set of circumstances?
Based on the set of circumstances that were provided, I would agree that they could have that understanding, seeing as it was a transfer of the victim in the case that led to the later conviction of the aiding and abetting case. However, where they were later found that they didn't have that probable cause at the trial. And then Another issue that I'd like to get into is whether the state can still require someone to register as a predatory offender when they are not legally required to do so. The district court already found this, and why we're here on to here on appeal today is to contest the statute of limitations primarily. And if any statute of limitations of period applies, I don't think it should be considered to have started until Mr. Siegel received proper notice that he should be required to register, and that would require that the BCA tell him to do so.
Where do you get that the BC is the notifying party? When I'm looking at the statute, Subdivision 2 lists a whole bunch of actors, if you will, who have an obligation to notify somebody of a registration requirement, including the court, including the corrections agent. I mean, what supports your argument that only the BCA's notice would require someone to actually register?
Thank you, Your Honor. And it again goes to the fact that they don't have the authority to determine. Again, as the statute says, that they cannot modify or change anyone's registration requirements based on a sentence or disposition order. So they don't have the authority to do it. It's the BCA who can hold someone to do it. And it's my understanding that this is a case of first impression where we have this later determination at trial where someone was acquitted of these predatory offenses, and we don't see, I guess, that the BCA intervening to find that these were wrongly required. They said that he was required to register based on the sentencing court, and they're saying that today. However, at the time, he shouldn't have been able to register based on that directed verdict of acquittal.
So this seems kind of simplistic, but in a way, the courts can't do anything because it's the BCA's responsibility as far as the regulation, the regulatory nature of it, but yet the BCA doesn't do anything because it's a court function.
I'm out of time, but if I could answer your question.
I don't know if it's really a question. The whole scheme of things is a curious.
It's just my belief that the BCA should have informed him that he would be able to contest his registration, because where they're the ones with the authority to do so, they should be the ones coming up rather than just leaving the, assigning the notice to another person when they don't have the authority to do anything about it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Attorney General Angela Kiza, appearing on behalf of the BCA. One of the first things I want to talk about is the language that the court may not modify the duty to register. That means the court, so the legislature has determined certain things require registration. That language, at least the way I understand it and the way the case law has described it, that's language that prevents the court from, for example, if somebody falls under the statute legally, they're convicted of third-degree crim sex, or they're clearly, it's clear that it's assault arising out of the same set of circumstances as kidnapping. The court can't then say, oh, the statute requires registration, but I'm going to modify that and say you don't have to register. That was the reason the legislature put that language in there. And there have been courts for years going back to...
But the court also can't impose registering.
Correct.
I think that's the point that appellant is trying to make, is that at the time the district court is offering the notification, there hasn't really been a determination yet as to whether or not they need to register, because the district court can't, in fact, make that determination.
But the legislation is what governs. The statute's what governs. The BCA doesn't make the determination. The BCA administers the statute. They're required to have people register. So the BCA can't say, oh, this guy, he was convicted of assault, but he didn't have the proper charges, but boy, he seems kind of dangerous. Let's make him register. I mean, the BCA administers the statute, so the court can't modify.
But that happens with lots of agency actions, and you don't actually have the agency action until you've had the final decision from the agency, right? So I can want to build my house closer to the lake and need to get a variance from the DNR, and the DNR has an obligation to apply the statute. But until the DNR has made the decision on whether or not I can build my house within the scope of the statute, you don't have a final decision. And I think that that's the argument that appellant is making, is that, yes, BCA might be obligated to take Act A or to Act B, but until BCA has actually taken an action, there is no notification. And I guess why is it wrong to look at the predatory offense and the actions of BCA in the way that you would look at other actions of an agency, that there needs to be some kind of decision first?
Because that is not what the statute provides for. What the statute specifically provides is certain convictions require registration. At the point of sentencing, he had the conviction that required registration. The court, and this was specifically addressed in the sentencing transcript, and the court specifically considered the issue and whether registration applied, and even specifically considered whether registration applied in light of the fact that the court granted the directed verdict of acquittal before, you know, it went to the jury or whatever. And the court has a notification. The statute requires the court to notify in that situation. And I guess my point on the modifying is, courts regularly have looked at, the Lopez court looked at whether there was probable cause for the charge registration offense. The Lopez court looked at what's required for same set of circumstances. The Berry court looked at what's required for same set of circumstances. Courts regularly look at whether the statute applies in order to give that notification that they're required to give under the statute. From a statute of limitations standpoint, from a civil lawsuit, which is what we have here, he had the notice from the court. He had the notice from, if you don't want to count the court's notice, then he goes to the Department of Corrections, who verifies with the BCA on BCA forms on which he acknowledges that under the statute he's required to register. That all happened within a couple of months of sentencing. So he's got the notice. He's got what's required to state a cause of action for his civil suit. Well, you know, within a couple of months. A statute does not require the BCA to give him explicit notice. For statute of limitations to run, what's required is that he has the elements to bring his cause of action.
Why is it appropriate to apply a statute of limitations to this kind of claim, which isn't about liability or money or other things that are usually related in a civil action, but is instead whether or not the state has authority to be taking the action that it's taking? It does seem to me that there are some analogies that can be drawn to the MCEA versus DNR case.
Well, I guess in the same vein as, I mean, the statute of limitations are there for a purpose. I mean, it's to prevent.
But you don't disagree that there isn't anything that explicitly says that the general 6-year statute of limitations applies to this type of claim. You look at you bring a Section 1983 claim or you bring a declaratory judgment claim, and then you have to determine what the underlying statute of limitation would be for the underlying claim. And I don't think that you necessarily disagree that the predatory offender statute doesn't have a statute of limitations.
The predatory offender registration statute is not a statute of limitations statute, but there is case law, including our Supreme Court, that has said the 6-year statute of limitations applies to these claims. In Franklin versus Evans just last year, our Supreme Court in that decision cited to Owens versus Ocure, United States Supreme Court decision at 488 U.S. 235. It cited to 54105. The Weavewood case holds that the statute of limitations applies in a declaratory judgment action, which is part of the actions here. In Franklin versus Evans at page 385, the court confirms that the 6-year statute of limitations applies in these cases. And the Franklin's versus Evans case is also dispositive on this whole continuing violation argument. That case specifically said that those are continuing consequences from the initial registration and not any kind of continuing action that suspends statute of limitations for the 6-year purposes. And I guess on this notice issue, I would just, I mean, everyone did under the statute what the statute specifically requires. The statute requires the court to give notice. The statute requires the corrections officer to give notice. He had his notice, and it was on BCA form. So essentially, you know, that notice was from the BCA in the form of those that checklist that he checks and signs and says that he understands his obligation under the statutes. And the whole point, I think, of that legislation, of those notification provisions, is fairness and is to make sure that the person gets notice as soon as possible.
Turning to the question of probable cause, how do you respond to the argument of the appellant here, which I think cites to State versus Lopez, for the proposition that the probable cause analysis really could be equated with the question of whether the facts appearing in the record, including reliable hearsay, would preclude the granting of a motion for a directed verdict or acquittal if proved at trial? It seems to support the argument that we should be considering probable cause in a broader light. How do you respond to that argument?
I guess in the case law that specifically pertains to predatory offender registration, what has been consistent is that it's been probable cause at the time of charging. The Lopez court, State versus Lopez, our Supreme Court, specifically said registration applies when there's probable cause at the time of charging. And I would note that in that case, that was a situation where the victim later recanted. And the registration still would have applied if it were the same set of circumstances. Ultimately, they found no same set of circumstances in that case, but it wasn't a matter of whether registration would have applied if there had been. They specifically said it would, you know, that it would apply based on probable cause at the time of charging. And I would say, you know, in a way, it's not a directed verdict situation, but it's a similar situation where some, you know, the evidence after the charging maybe wasn't as good, and ultimately there was a plea agreement because of that, where the kidnapping was dismissed and the the defendants pled guilty to the other charges because of that. But and really, that should be the same, you know, whether a case doesn't get to the jury because the judge says, okay, at this point there's not enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, or whether a case is negotiated and dismissed by the prosecutor because they're partially dismissed and they still have to register for the plea, that should be treated the same. Those are the same kind of situations. It's just a different way the case was resolved by that, you know, falling off of evidence prior to trial or prior to the plea. And I also think it's very similar to the Halkos case. Yes, Halkos ultimately did go to the jury on the fourth degree criminal sexual conduct charge, but the burden of proof at that point, when this judge directed the verdict of acquittal, they're saying no reasonable jury can convict. So they're saying you can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. They're not saying there's not probable cause. So
is the difference between Lopez and Halkos simply the fact that there had been a contested probable cause hearing in Lopez, as I understand reading the case, that there had been a Florence hearing versus Hawkins in this case where we didn't have a challenge to probable cause?
That I'm not sure about, but in Hawkins, I do know that later on, I think at the time of sentencing, they finally challenged probable cause, and the Halkos court, again, you know, not just on the complaint, but the Halkos court did find probable cause again down the road at the time of sentencing, and that the registration applied despite the verdict of acquittal. And this court in the Halkos case specifically said the fact that the state ultimately failed to prove elements of the fourth degree criminal sexual conduct charge beyond a reasonable doubt does not compel the conclusion that probable cause was lacking. And this court has specifically said that's not a proper analogy. And respectfully, as far as the court below in the civil case, in this case, I disagree with that, with analogizing that, because it's not. It's at a much later part in the proceedings. Whether or not the tests are similar or the same, it's a completely different, as Judge Larson pointed out, it's a completely different part of the case. A lot of things happen between the time when somebody's charged and the time of the conviction, whether there's an acquittal of some of the registration charges, whether there's a negotiation and they're dismissed.
I'd like to briefly come back to the Franklin v. Evans case, because I looked back. It does look to me like Franklin v. Evans was just a Section 1983 claim and not a state declaratory judgment action. Do you think that Franklin is dispositive on state declaratory judgment actions as well with regard to the application of the six-year statute of limitations?
My understanding was it was both. I would have to look back at the complaint. And maybe they didn't mention it because maybe that's ultimately not what was. I can't remember what all they argued on, you know, what all issues they brought. Because oftentimes they start with, like, six issues and then they don't all go up on that. But
because I do think that the case that they're relying on specifically regards state-specific declaratory judgment actions as opposed to Section 1983 claims. Because I went back and I looked, my recollection was correct that in Franklin they're applying the, you know, federal law with regard to the application of what statute of limitation applies to Section 1983 actions under federal law. And so I just wanted to know what your position was with regard to its applicability to our state declaratory judgment action.
So my position is that it's a six-year statute of limitations on any of the claims here, regardless of how you look at it, because it's either under the Section 1983, which says, Okoure says, that for Section 1983, that the personal injury apply, and under our statute 541, personal injury is 6 years. So it applies under that for Section 1983, to the extent that it's a declaratory judgment action, then the case law that says declaratory action applies in that 6 years too. So.
Well, case law says that a declaratory judgment action applies the statute of limitation for the underlying claim. And this was my question to you. Why isn't this like MCEA, where it's just a statute that doesn't have a statute of limitation for the purpose of a state declaratory judgment action as opposed to a 1983 action?
You know, I'm not familiar with the other statutes you're referring to, but I just know in the case law that we've cited in our brief, and that my understanding was that Franklin, too, pretty much reaffirmed that it was 6 years for these cases. So these cases are all brought as Section 1983 actions, and usually with the declaratory judgment part of it for the registration, saying registration shouldn't apply to them. So I would say that that's the declaratory action. That's what brings it into the declaratory action part of it.
Okay.
Makes sense?
Yep, it does. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. I would ask you to affirm the dismissal on statute of limitations grounds, and if for some reason you don't do that, I would ask that you find that he is required to register under our statute based on the judgment of acquittal and the conviction out of the same set of circumstances. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to make three quick points here on rebuttal. First of all, I'd like to point out that requiring someone to register as a predatory offender where they shouldn't be legally required to register is cruel. Being labeled as a predator carries massive weight in the United States, and it's honestly hard to think of another label that could have such a bad feeling when you hear it come up, and when anyone kind of thinks of somebody being labeled as a predator, they look the other way, they turn around, they don't want to have anything to do with that individual. Mr. Siegel's initial wrongful registration at the start of his prison sentence already prevented him from opportunities that would allow him to get out early release, or participating in programs that would allow him to reduce his sentence as well. And if that time in prison isn't enough, outside of the prison walls, he faces that same scrutiny from the public that I just mentioned, what happens when someone is labeled as a predator. Second, I'd just like to bring up again that the ECA is saying that they're just simply applying the statute here and that it would be fine for a sentencing court or the DOC to even notify somebody of this because the BCA is telling them that they can do it. I'd like to bring up Jones versus Evans again, where all the parties in that case were in agreement that the individual should not have had to register, or they agreed that he wouldn't have to register, and even the sentencing court went through with that agreement, and the BCA found that he was still required to register and required him to do so because he was legally required to do so under the statute. Here it's imperative that the BCA is the one giving notice to Mr. Siegel that he is required to register and how he could go about contesting it, because we're the only party with the actual authority to do something in this matter is upholding a wrongful requirement from a sentencing court or the DOC. They need to step in and provide that notice when it was wrongfully required in the first place so that they can do something about it. If an individual doesn't know how to go about that, they wouldn't be able to contest it, and especially when the limitations of prison life can restrict their other access to resources, it's hard to know how they'd be able to contest something without even knowing where to start.
Counsel, when do you argue that your client got notice? Because I think part of the state's argument is it in this case it doesn't really matter because the 6-year statute has run whether you look at the sentencing court date or the date that he signed all of the forms once he was in custody. Are you also arguing that notification was not enough?
I would argue that, Your Honor, and it simply because I don't know if the BCA ever initially came up to him at any point and said, hey, you have to do this, until he was out of prison and he was told that he needs to be registering. So all that time could have passed and he could have done something about
it. And so how much time has passed since he has been out of custody and was told by BCA he had to register?
I'm not 100% sure on that, but I believe he has been out for the last 4 years, and we've been contesting his registration since around 2021. So we've kind of been working on that. And then I guess the last thing that I would like to bring up here is that with the judicial determination from the district court, which we're here today on appeal, finding that Mr. Siegel is not legally required to register as a predatory offender, Mr. Siegel couldn't even be reasonably charged with failure to register as a predatory offender, because the first step is requiring, or an individual has to be legally required to register as a predatory offender for them to be charged with failing to register as a predatory offender.
Counsel, how do you respond to the state's application of Franklin v. Evans, and why isn't that dispositive of the statute of limitations argument in this case?
I think that with all the other cases that apply statute of limitations and time bar, it all is different where there is the determination here that he was wrongfully required to register. And I don't think that, kind of similar to a habeas corpus claim where actual innocence can prove that one shouldn't be convicted anymore, it can withdraw that and make things better. And I guess that would be the end of my argument, just saying that he was actually innocent here based on the district court's findings, which is brought here today on appeal. And the statute of limitations shouldn't bar someone from doing something when their rights are at stake.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel in this case. This case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in this matter within the time prescribed by statute.